From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we talk with bioethicist Craig Klugman about the ethics of technology and why observation is so crucial in the practice of medicine. Then some parents worry that getting multiple vaccines at one time can be traumatizing for their child. An expert on immunization says this fear is unfounded.
There have been actually studies looking at levels of cortisol, which is a stress hormone released by kids, and shows that just a regular visit is, or one vaccine is no different than five.
And our Fit for You series visits the womb room, a place that goes beyond simply offering pre- and postnatal yoga classes.
For me, the emphasis is on not just including a pregnant person in a regular yoga class in a way that's safe for them, but creating community with other people that are in the same phase of life.
Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. Merriam-Webster defines ethics as, quote, a set of moral principles, a theory or system of moral values, and the principles of conduct that govern an individual or a group, unquote. Our next guest makes his living applying both of those definitions to such fields as bioethics, digital medicine, end-of-life issues, public health and research ethics, and health policy. Craig Klugman is a professor of bioethics and health humanities at the Department of Health Sciences at DePaul University in Chicago. He's also the author of more than 450 articles, book chapters, and blog posts on bioethics. Dr. Klugman was in Milwaukee in November to deliver the Medical College of Wisconsin's annual medical humanities lecture, and we welcomed him to the show then. Craig Klugman, it is such a pleasure to have you on Lake Effect. Thanks so much for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
I want to start with the notion of ethics. Let's start big.
Okay.
How much time do you have, right?
I got all day.
Yeah, okay. Why is there such a focus, do you think, on ethics, particularly bioethics right now? What is driving the interest, public interest?
Well, I think life is changing so fast. I mean, if you think about artificial intelligence, if you think about we now can have babies that exist in bags, at least for lambs, we're working on that. And if you think about genetics, that now, you know, in your kitchen, you could actually manipulate genetics of a small organism. And things are happening such a rapid pace that the question becomes, should we be doing this? How we should be doing this? Should we be regulating it? Should we be allowing just anybody to do this or restricting it more? So we get these big stories, like last year, the birth of the two girls who were in genetically engineered embryos, and we get end-of-life issues. And people have been struggling for the last 50 years about how to make sense of these rapid changes in technology and medicine, that we're left with this question of what should we do and what should we not do. And so bioethics has sort of arisen to have these public conversations, both on a professional level and on a community level.
It feels to me like ethics has lagged behind the technological advances. That, you know, it, as you say, it's moving so fast mm-hmm. that you just barely get your head around one thing and five others pop up.
I say that I spend most of my time as an academic just keeping up with the news, trying to know what's going on and happening. Yes. So if we think about the technology happens, and what we try to do in ethics is react to that as well as anticipate it, right? So we want to get to the point where we've created frameworks and structures that exist, and we can think about these new adaptations happening. But we also are in the situation of we're much faster than anything they can do in law or regulation. So if the technology is happening at light speed, the ethics is happening at the speed of sound, and regulation is kind of the turtle bringing up the rear.
I was going to say geological time.
Yeah, basically glacial sorts
of
things.
Is there any movement to actually bring ethicists on board with technology teams?
There's a little bit. So there's some of us who do consultations. I was working for a few years with a pharmaceutical company that was doing a high-tech intervention. And so they brought on a team of ethicists to sort of figure out what are the issues, what do we need to be concerned about. And they changed things based on what we suggested. They changed their consent process. We had a social justice concern about who would have access to these technologies. And so they actually went out and made sure that people could have access to it, which required going to the FDA and having them change some of their rules. And it took years, but it happened. But as far as, like, you know, artificial intelligence in cars, they're looking at less working with people in ethics. Google famously put together an ethics group to deal with its AI program. And that group lasted less than a week before they were disbanded, in part because they weren't using so much professional ethicists as people who were politically good for their bottom line.
Or motivated in a different way.
Yeah, I'm trying to be polite here.
I guess.
But they, you know, there was so much outrage over some of the people they were having on their committee that they actually disbanded it within a week. So it has not been as much as we'd like to see, as much as the thoughtfulness. You know, we get wrapped up with this new technology and the excitement of it and the things we can do and the lives we can change, that sometimes we just need to breathe and take a pause. And I think that's what we do in ethics, is we create a sacred space where we can have these conversations as communities, as individuals, in the hospital, outside the hospital, in the state house, in the corporate boardrooms, to ask, you know, what direction should we be going?
But I'll bet that there's a certain amount of people accusing you of being wet blankets.
So there are people who have written and saying that we exist to prevent technology from moving forward, that we exist to stop research. And the reality is, we're not. That good ethics makes for good research. Good ethical thought leads to better technologies that, you know, help improve lives rather than just being focused on improving the bottom line. You know, so for example, a lot of people are concerned when they have to go through a human subjects review board that this is preventing them from doing their work. But the reality is, the most basic part of that is, are you doing good science? Like, we shouldn't be wasting the time and energy of bringing in research subjects and exposing them to potential harms if there's nothing good that will come out of it. And so we actually force you to make sure you're doing good science. That's primary.
And we also don't want a repeat of Tuskegee or any of those other kinds of things that have been proven to not only be bad science, but really horrific to the participants who didn't know what they were getting into.
Exactly. We want to make sure that there's transparency and honesty, and that people are doing science that benefits society as well as doesn't harm people, you know, just because they're members of a group. Or, you know, there's lots of research that could be done if we didn't care what happened to the subjects. And, you know, we have Tuskegee, we have the Nazi era, we have the radiation experiments, we have the Guatemala syphilis studies. I mean, we're finding things all the time, unfortunately. But we want to make sure that we do stuff that is good for people and good for technology and good for society overall.
You talked about having something that we get excited about and we're not thinking through all of the implications. And of course, the first thing that comes to my mind is 23andMe, Ancestry.com. To put, you know, not that they're bad. It's sure. That we don't know what's being done with that information. It's really cool to know that, you know, you have family members over in some place you had no idea. Right. And all of the shows that come up, you know, that people are saying, finding out about their ancestry, finding out all of these things. We love that. As humans, we want that story. But how do we regulate that? How do we apply ethics to that so that whatever we find out isn't used against us?
Well, there hasn't been regulation of this space. Remember that 23andMe was founded by the wife of one of the Google founders. So these are not companies that really are in the business of finding out who your family members are or finding out what diseases you might have. They're in the business of collecting data. You know, we are the product. We are not the customer. The customer are researchers and governments and data banks. That's who they're going after. We just provide the content for them, and we're paying for that right to do it. There's challenges that come with this, with having your information out there. I mean, we do have a law called GINA, the Genetic Information Non-Disclosure Act, which protects you from having your genetic information used in employment or health insurance. But that doesn't apply to long-term care insurance. It doesn't apply to life insurance. It doesn't apply to whether you get a job in the first place necessarily, or where you live, whether you have access to different types of assistive devices or can get different types of support from the government. It actually is a pretty weak law. So these things can be used against us in the future. And it's not just us, because when you provide that DNA sample, you're actually connecting 300 of your closest relatives. This has come up a lot recently in cases like the Golden State Killer, where now we have law enforcement wanting to use these databases, and they're really great databases to catch killers. And they're people who do not exist in the federal database for criminals, right? So those tend to be people who are people of color because they're more likely to get involved with the and to get arrested and get convicted in the system. And so people who were more white, who were not in those other, the federal databases, now we're able to find the connections that they committed these crimes. But we're actually not looking for them. We're looking for their families. So, you know, Golden State Killer was found and somebody found a third cousin and then was able to link the, reconstruct the family tree. If you look at the terms of use for Ancestry and 23andMe, none of them guarantee you privacy. They do have privacy statements, but it's that they will, you know, strip away your name if they use things. But your DNA is an identifier by itself. And there have been a lot of studies that come out of MIT's done quite a few of them that show it is pretty easy to re-identify, de-identify data. So if my third cousin, who I don't even know, puts their stuff in, people can find out information about me, even though I've never done it. I've told my immediate family never to do it.
I have never done it, even though I am tempted, because it would be fun to find that stuff
absolutely.
Out. Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, day one of my intro to bioethics class, I tell students we'll do our genetics chapter, but before we get there, don't do these. Don't buy it for a gift for someone. Because if you read those terms again, it says for entertainment purposes only. So even
so, that's how they get around the ethical issues.
Right. They also had been giving some health advice for a while. The FDA called them out on that. And now they have to submit for each disease that they're better indicators. But there's so many things we don't know about the whole DNA area. I mean, there's no regulation on the laboratories. You give three laboratories the same sample, they're going to give you three different things because they're looking for different markers. They have different databases to compare to. There are cases of people finding out that they are one ethnicity or from one particular geographic region. And then a few years later, they're given an update and they're a totally different ethnicity because the database has expanded during that time. So this is not as certain. It's not like watching CSI and it's, you know, we always get our person. It changes as we learn more information and because there's no standard for how the labs run.
So how do you, as a professional ethicist and somebody who's trying very hard to get people to understand the ripples of all of this, how do you get them to do that? How do you say, hey, look, this is what you're doing. This is what you're giving away when you sign up for one of these things.
So in part, we do public conversations. Like I'm here to give the 14th Annual Medical Humanities Lecture at MCW. So we bring the public in to talk about these things. We teach in our classroom. We write op-eds. We write blogs. We actually talk to our legislators and try and get them on board and understand what's happening. We try to get people engaged to know that this is happening and to try and get their elected officials and their family not to do it and to think about what regulations we need and what laws we want to pass.
Even though those will be slow in getting passed.
It'll be very slow, but, you know, this is a long-term project. This is the future of humanity. So we're not about the short-term getting an answer today. We want to lay out good frameworks and good structures for tomorrow.
One of the other things that you do that I have to say I found really fascinating is your art rounds. And this we're kind of shifting gears here away. Well, ethics still play a part in this, but I love the idea of visual literacy. And I'm hoping you can tell us a little more about what you mean by that and why it's important for health professionals in particular to have it.
So we live in a very visual culture, right? We've with the rise of cell phones and emojis, language is, you know, the textual language is becoming less and less of what we do and so much more of the visual, you know, Netflixing and, you know, watching TV and graphic imagery. So we have to understand what these images are and what they mean and where they come from. And so the idea of visual literacy, especially in medicine, is that a lot of medicine is just looking at people. You know, you come up with a differential diagnosis based on their symptoms, but sometimes just looking at a person, you can see what fits, what doesn't fit. And as a patient, to be seen is a really profound experience. It creates a connection to your healthcare provider. There is a sense of a placebo effect, just being seen and heard and witnessed. And so what we've been doing with art is trying to increase visual literacy and visual observation skills through the use of museum art, and that's the Art Rounds program. And so we take medical students and nursing students, and we make them work together, because even though we train them separately, when they're in the clinic, they work in teams together. So we make them work together, and we teach them a process called VTS, Visual Thinking Strategies, which is actually used for little kids to teach them how to engage in art. And it's three simple questions. What do you see? What do you see that makes you think that? What more do you see? And we do this over and over. And we'll look at a single piece of art for a half hour. Now, the average person in a museum looks at a piece of art for 8 seconds.
I was going to say 2 minutes. I was being generous.
Yeah, no, yeah. 8 seconds. Yeah. There's been studies on this. And so to have to look at a piece for that long, you really begin to see things. And this is a skill that you can develop so that the next time, maybe you don't need to spend 30 minutes looking. One of the things we did in Art Rounds was, how do you take looking at a piece of art and then bring that to the clinic when you're looking at a patient? So we got models, and we put models in the galleries. And on the very last session, we do multiple sessions, we have the students look at the models as if they are a piece of art, and they're describing things. And for the models, when you ask them what this experience was like, they felt very exposed, because they're, every flaw is being pointed out, every little mark, every, you know, one nostril's higher than the other, just things that most of us would never realize or ignore or want to know about. We've done some pre and post review of this assessment and found that actually having them make the transition to the patient, a model from the piece of art, gives them that transference ability. And, you know, the patients feel more seen, more witnessed, more observed. And in the long run, this can save money in the healthcare system, because you don't necessarily have to rely on the high technology if you can just spend time looking and seeing, oh, they have this mark. They don't have this thing that's often common in this case.
It sounds like it's an offshoot of the standardized patient, the idea of a real person coming in and you having to do a differential diagnosis as a medical student. You know?
And actually, we started it through the standardized patient program.
Oh, did
program.
You? Okay, yeah. So that makes sense, because it sounds like it would be something that would help that.
I mean, there's kind of an irony in this, in that part of the whole work of the medical humanities is helping healthcare providers see patients as people with their full, rich stories and histories and experiences. And yet we're putting people in a gallery and saying, look at them as objects. So there's a little piece of this that bothers me that we're doing it. But we also let the students know that, you know, this is not how you address a patient where you just stare at them for a half hour and point out all their flaws, that this is just a tool that they're learning along the way.
It helps them see better.
It does.
That's the idea.
It does. Yeah. And, you know, we spend so little time looking at things anymore. You know, 8 seconds in a museum where you're going a place to look. But, you know, when you're scrolling through your feeds on your phone, when you're driving, you just, things barely enter your consciousness anymore. And we're just trying to say, slow down, take a moment, just look. And you will be much more effective as a healer, and your patients will feel much more appreciated.
What would you say to the patients? What's the reverse? Do they need to be paying attention in the same way?
Well, you know, one of my projects with the medical humanities is that it's not just for healthcare providers, that it's for everybody, because we are all either future patients or future lay caregivers. And yes, you should be paying attention to what your doctor does. Are they looking at you? Do they make eye contact? Or are they just staring into a computer screen the whole time, which many healthcare systems actually encourage? And to ask for what you need. I need you to look at me when I say this. You know, I want you to see this rash I have. There's something unusual about it. You need to ask for what you want and need as a patient, because it's not necessarily there anymore, because we've become such a corporatized system of healthcare.
Right, which is one of the big complaints. You're just a number.
Sometimes you feel that way. Very often you feel that way.
Right. Which is what you're hoping to move people away.
We are. We're trying to take doctors and medical students who are trained to take standardized tests, and that there are right and wrong answers. And by injecting the humanities into their training, we're teaching them there's no right answer. There's no right way to interpret a piece of art. There's no right answer to what this, you know, misty thing is in the background. There's what you see. So we get them comfortable with ambiguity, which is something we do not teach in med school, where it's all there is a right answer and there's a wrong answer.
That, in science, ambiguity is a difficult thing. Yeah.
Yes. And science itself is what we read in a journal article is the outcome of interpretation of data and observation. And, you know, all of this, the subjectivity of science and medicine is something that we don't talk about that often, which is why the humanities approaches is so important for people who are professionally going to be doing this, to understand that, you know, a data point is not necessarily just a number. There's a story behind it, and what it means depends on the context in which it exists.
And that's where the ethics come in, too.
And then you round back to ethics.
Exactly. Yes. Well, Craig Klugman, it has been such a pleasure. I have enjoyed this thoroughly. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Craig Klugman is a professor of bioethics and health humanities at the Department of Health Sciences at DePaul University in Chicago. He's also the co-director of the university's minor in bioethics and society. Klugman was in Milwaukee last fall to deliver the medical humanities lecture at the Medical College of Wisconsin. We spoke with him then. You can learn more about Professor Klugman's work at WUWM.com. We'll take a short break and then look at some of the misperceptions about vaccinations. Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR in just a moment. We are back with more of Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Our world is a much different place since vaccines became a common part of medical care. Once common diseases like polio and smallpox have been eradicated or are rarely contracted today. But there remains a lot of public skepticism over the safety of vaccines, which has led people to not get them, which has led to outbreaks of serious preventable diseases like measles. Dr. Joyce Sanchez is a professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin who specializes in infectious diseases. She joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers this past July and started their conversation by answering a pretty basic question. How do vaccines work?
It's something that can be easily explainable even to my six-year-old son. What vaccines do is they prime the human body to recognize germs if it comes into contact with them later on. So, for example, I like the analogy of the militia. So our bodies have white blood cells or immune cells that essentially develop an antibody or a flag when it comes into contact with a germ so that later on down the line, the body can remember what it came into contact with and flag the germ more readily, more easily, so that the person doesn't come down with illness. What vaccines do is they take advantage of the immune system. So some example of a vaccine is the flu vaccine. So that's a dead flu virus or a piece of a flu virus that we inject to a person. Their white blood cells make this flag or antibody so that if they come into contact with the flu later on in the fall or the winter, they don't actually come down with the illness because their white cells can kill the flu virus very readily.
So I think some people hear that and they're like, okay, well, you're putting a flu virus inside of me. Could that make me sick? Why are we able to put these kinds of viruses into something like a vaccine and not become ill?
That's a very common question I get in my clinic from patients, parents, and people alike who are getting the vaccine themselves. Some vaccines do cause some adverse effects. Usually they're very, very minor, things like a low-grade fever or some muscle soreness in the arm where the injection occurred. But what these vaccines do is they actually take either a weakened version of the virus, so those are live viral vaccines, where they're mutated so that your body can recognize them, but they don't actually cause illness. Another form is a killed virus, where we take the virus and kill it. So you're basically seeing pieces of the virus, but the virus is not actively multiplying or causing illness. Other forms of vaccines, like a toxin-derived vaccine, like the tetanus vaccine, which most people get every 10 years. That takes a toxin that the bacteria produces, but the toxin itself is not harmful.
You know, there are a lot of misconceptions when it comes to vaccines. I think a lot of people have heard, you know, the autism misconception, which has been widely debunked. What are some of the things that people come in and say or ask about that you have to kind of work against?
My general approach to someone who is vaccine hesitant or someone who may be on the fence is I listen to them very carefully to hear what their concerns are. And I think one of the number one concerns, particularly for parents who are bringing their children in for vaccines, is the concern about safety with the vaccine. You can see your child, a six-month-old. I remember my son when he was 6 months old getting five shots in two legs and thinking, wow, could that be traumatizing to my son or to later my daughter? And the quick answer to that is one shot or even just a visit to a pediatrician causes stress to a baby, and five vaccines doesn't cause any additional stress to baby. There have been actually really well looked at studies looking at levels of cortisol, which is a stress hormone released by kids, and shows that just a regular visit is or one vaccine is no different than five. I think the biggest concern, though, is that vaccines, it's been said, are a victim of their own success. So we no longer have that memory of what things were like before vaccines were around. For example, in the 1950s, polio vaccine responsible for 500,000 paralyzed people and deaths every year in the United States. We don't see polio anymore because the vaccine is so efficacious. Similar with measles. Measles was eradicated in 2000, no active transmission, but as more and more communities have decided not to vaccinate their children because they're not seeing measles, don't think it's a concern, and are concerned about side effects, have chosen not to vaccinate. So I listen, and then I try to address some of the concerns depending on what they bring to the table.
Well, and there's a feeling among some that, you know, things like the measles or chickenpox, something that we didn't vaccinate against when I was little, you know, that these aren't really serious diseases. What do you say to people who, you know, think that, well, it's not going to hurt my kid if they have the measles?
That's a very common question and point that parents bring up, too. For the vast majority of people who get measles, it can be a mild illness. But I'll tell you right now, Joy, that 1 in 1,000 children and adults who contract measles actually develop very serious complications. What are those? Serious pneumonia that can require hospitalization, or something called encephalitis or swelling of the brain that can cause someone to be demented and not think properly. And when we weigh the risks of those issues, so 1 in 1,000, with the risk of serious adverse effects from the vaccine, it's less than 1 in 1,000,000 that actually get a serious adverse effect. So when I talk to patients about the risks, I weigh those two odds of probability.
You know, you talked about earlier the kind of trauma that might be associated with getting one vaccine versus getting five vaccines. And there are some parents who decide to have a kind of elongated schedule that's really against what's suggested by doctors. Is there any danger in doing that?
When we study vaccines, we study them on a specific schedule to know how efficacious they are, how effective they are in real life, in the real world population every day. And so when we report out vaccine efficacy, it's based on those schedules. The risk of delaying vaccines later on down the line is you're taking a child who is at the most vulnerable state. They're infants and young children who do not have matured immune systems, and they're young, and if they get sick, they don't have the stamina to really withstand serious illness and can die from vaccine-preventable illnesses. So my argument against expanding or elongating the amount of time between vaccines is you're unnecessarily exposing your child to highly vaccine-preventable illnesses for no reason and potentially putting on a schedule where we don't really know the efficacy.
Yeah. What are some of the vaccines that have been developed over, say, the last 20 years? I think some people are familiar with the HPV vaccine, which has been, you know, highly promoted.
I love that you bring up the HPV vaccine. Some people describe this as the holy grail of vaccines because it's the only one known to protect against cancer. Cancer. So HPV vaccine came out in the late 1990s, early 2000s. I remember because I was a teenager at the time and was very eager to get protected myself. The HPV or human papillomavirus vaccine is the only one known to protect against cervical cancer in women. Interestingly enough, this virus has also been associated with head and neck cancers in men and women. And as someone who treats patients for infectious diseases, if they get a head and neck cancer and it gets infected, it can be very disfiguring and very distressing. And so I see the consequences of infection with this virus over the long term. So this is a wonderful, relatively new, it's not new anymore, but relatively new vaccine that I highly encourage young adults and even adults up to the age of 45 to get. We used to administer it to people 26 years of age and younger, and a lot of people thought that they missed the boat. But the FDA just this past year approved its use for people 45 years and younger. So we're starting to protect people who are older than their mid-20s now, which is exciting.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned, of course, that for a bit, older adults weren't able to get the vaccine. And at least from my little bit of research that I've done, there were some vaccines that I didn't really know were an option, I guess. What are some of these lesser-known vaccines that are available to adults?
Sure. A lot of people have heard of the shingles. And shingles is essentially a resurgence of the chickenpox virus that people may have been infected with when they were younger, infants, young adults. The shingles vaccine, there was an older formulation of it that has been available for a long time. However, just last spring of 2018, a brand new version of the shingles vaccine was released and approved for use by the FDA, and it has much higher efficacy now. It's upwards of 95% or more in preventing the dreaded shingles, pretty painful rash that can occur the older that we get after having been exposed to chickenpox. It's two doses, so I encourage people to talk to their primary care providers or check with their pharmacies, because this highly anticipated vaccine was in such demand that there was actually a national shortage. Thankfully, the vaccine manufacturer has come up to speed with the demand, and so we're starting to administer it more, but there's still wait lists at several pharmacies for patients. It's been approved for use for those 60 and above. However, it's also approved for use for those 15 and above, so I encourage people to check with their insurance if they're between 50 and 60 years old to make sure it's covered so that they're not stuck with an out-of-pocket cost.
Yeah. And if you've had chickenpox before, I had thought that, you know, if you had chickenpox when you were a kid, that now you're fine. You're not going to get shingles as an adult. I learned from a friend of mine who got shingles that that is not the case.
You're absolutely right about that, Joy. So only individuals who have been infected or had previous exposure to chickenpox are at risk of developing shingles later in life. The type of virus that is responsible for chickenpox and shingles is a virus that lives dormant in the nervous system of our bodies for the rest of our lives. And under times of stress or as we get older or if we have health problems or are on medications to bring down the militia or the immune system we have in our bodies, that's when the virus really takes advantage and comes out again in the form of shingles.
Speaking of things that you get as an adult, you know, there are a number of different vaccines that don't protect you for your entire life. What are the things that you need to re-vaccinate for as an adult?
Many vaccines do offer lifelong immunity, or essentially the equivalent to lifelong immunity, all things considered. For example, after two doses of the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine or MMR vaccine, the chance of having lifelong immunity is upwards of 97%+. So some of those you don't need. Others, for example, the killed versions of the vaccines are less effective and require boosters, as you alluded to. The tetanus vaccine is a classic example. Tetanus vaccine, there are two formulations. The one that I generally give has three components to it: tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis. Those are all vaccine-preventable illnesses. And we know that even after 3 years after the vaccine, that the pertussis component or protection wanes over time. This is especially important for women who are pregnant because pertussis is a very deadly illness for infants and young children. So a few years ago, the recommendation was to vaccinate pregnant women, even if it's been less than 10 years since their last tetanus combined vaccine.
What is pertussis?
Pertussis is a respiratory illness. It causes significant pneumonia and respiratory distress, breathing problems in infants and young children, and has actually previously been responsible for many deaths nationwide every year before the advent of the vaccine.
Aside from that vaccination, are there any others that you really do need to get a booster that you may not know about?
Absolutely. So we live in a world that has more and more travel going on. We're more and more connected globally. So especially for those who plan to travel internationally, I highly recommend that they talk to their primary care physician or actually seek guidance from a travel clinic. There are certain vaccines that do need boosters. For example, there's an illness called typhoid fever that tends to be prominent in developing countries of Africa, Southeast Asia, Latin America, for example. The longest duration is the oral vaccine that lasts only 5 years. We talked about tetanus vaccine every 10 years. For some individuals, particularly those who smoke cigarettes or those who have conditions that makes their immune system suppressed or not as robust, we often recommend pneumonia vaccine boosters. For those who turn age 65, that's a general recommendation to give to everybody, regardless of what other medical conditions they may have. So those are some examples.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you think people really need to know about vaccines?
I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. Social media, the internet, that is readily accessible. That's one of the wonderful things about the age we live in. But it's also a downfall of the age we live in, is there's a lot of misinformation. So for those who are hesitant or worried about safety of vaccinations, I highly recommend that they talk to their providers about their concerns so that they can get the real data, the valid data, and not some of this misinformation.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Sanchez, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you for having me, Joy.
Dr. Joy Sanchez is a professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She specializes in infectious diseases. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in July. We will take one last break, and then Fit for You visits a yoga studio that encourages parents to bring their kids. Lake Effect Weekend continues in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. You may be familiar with that chant practiced in yoga, but it may be unexpected to hear kids playing during the stereotypically Zen moment. There are plenty of yoga classes at local gyms and even studios dedicated to the practice, but finding pre- and postnatal yoga is still tough. For expecting and new parents, it's often hard to coordinate getting somewhere to exercise, especially if childcare is involved. One local yoga instructor wanted to fill that void by creating a place for parents to come not just for yoga, but for community. Amy Kranz is the founder of the Womb Room in Milwaukee. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski joined her in August for a Fit for You segment. Kranz explained then that pre- and postnatal yoga is about more than just poses and breathing exercises.
Some of it is about the yoga and the postures and getting to know your body. And a big piece of it is about creating community with other people that are pregnant and postpartum. So for me, the emphasis is on not just including a pregnant person in a regular yoga class in a way that's safe for them, but creating community with other people that are in the same phase of life. And in a way that feels safe, in a way that feels where we can feel better in our bodies and our hearts and our minds when we walk away from it. So I guess it's wonderful to have a teacher, a yoga teacher, be trained in prenatal yoga. It's another thing to create a community for people that are in that phase of life with the benefit of you're doing yoga together.
Exactly.
See what I'm saying? So the community is primary. and the yoga is bonus rather than the other way around.
Right. So before we touch upon your physical space and the community you're creating, can you touch upon how pre- and postnatal yoga differ from a typical yoga format class that anyone could walk into a studio or say their local gym that offers classes? You know, what are women's bodies experiencing during this time that you are being mindful of in adjusting positions or breath or body awareness?
Yeah, there's a lot of pieces. So another job that I have is as a birth doula. And so there are pieces that go into prenatal yoga that are really about preparing for birth. So preparing to be more connected to your breath, preparing to open up the body in a certain way to allow baby to move out more easily. So I think that at least in the focus of my classes, I try to sort of replicate the labor journey in the class so that the rhythm of labor is something that's sort of installed in them before they actually end up in the physical journey of labor. So maybe starting out with slower movements where they're getting in touch with their body, but they're not quite so taxed by the positions that they're in. It's sort of a turning inward, turning in and tuning in to ourselves and our babies, and then slowly building that workload until we get up to the really, really intense things like maybe a squat or a goddess pose or a warrior sequence where they really can look at the edge of their physicality and say, you know, I can't, if they can even say inside of their minds, I can't do this, that's going to happen to pretty much everybody when they're in labor. And so if you can get to that point where you can feel the feeling of I can't do this before you're in labor, you can realize what the thoughts are that go along with that, what your breath, how your breath changes when that happens. So it's a way of sort of feeling out the gesture of birth before you're actually in the birth journey itself. Even in the postpartum and as parents in general, we see that rhythm over and over again, the rhythm of this is pretty intense, but then all of a sudden, next thing you know, everybody's having a tantrum at once in the middle of Aldi and you're just trying to get out of the grocery store. And you're like, I can't do this. And then you tap into something. So these skills that they're working with in class, they can use anywhere. And I guess that's part of the reason, too, that I include or that we include the children in the class as far as being in the physical space with us, because this is not meant to be a practice that we take outside of our lives and doesn't in any way translate into our lives. We want it to translate into our lives. We want our lives to be from a place of more comfort and ease and steadiness.
Everything is optional, so every posture is optional. Getting off of your mat is optional. Saying bag it and laying down and taking a nap is optional. Whatever you need to do is okay, and whatever they need to do is okay. So.
Right. Some people may think it's counterintuitive to go to a yoga class where your kids are also there with you and they are playing in the back corner, perhaps having a little tantrum, whatever the needs may be, or perhaps you need to stop to breastfeed your child. You know, when people typically think of yoga as going into this zen zone, it's completely quiet, you know, a little too quiet for people sometimes.
Right.
But for parents, you can't escape this.
Right.
In your everyday. It's your 24/7.
Right.
So what have you heard from mothers who couldn't find this kind of space before? Because a lot of times mothers, whether it's pre or postnatal, they have difficulties finding gyms that
yes.
perhaps offer a daycare, or, you know, they simply can't find the childcare to go
right.
away and take a class themselves.
Yeah, I think it's what I've heard is that it's a huge relief to be able to come to class and not have to find somewhere for the kids. And the other thing is just there are some parents who are, it's really anxiety provoking to think of leaving their kids in a childcare facility, even if it's within the gym itself. So the fact that they can be there and at the same time they have their own space, everything is childproof, so you don't have to worry about danger that way. And they also get to experience acceptance towards themselves, their journey towards each other and their own parenting journey. And as everything happens, everything just happens. We're working also on not judging ourselves, not judging each other, not judging each other's children. If somebody throws a yoga block at your face, or how many times we've had toddlers that have like taken a bite out of an infant. Or
something. Right, right.
Not literally. But the, you know, working with that, that's a big piece and a big, it's a stressful piece of parenting is being with other parents and wondering whether or not you're being judged or not, whether your child's behavior is being judged or not. And so having that safe space to go, we're all kind of in this together and we're all invested in these kids, not just our own kids, but all the kids that are here. And so seeing them as human beings instead of as the kid that threw the block in my head during Shavasana.
A lot of times new parents can feel very isolated. You know, just the schedules of taking care of a newborn is very trying.
Right.
So how do you facilitate a place that continues to reinforce that message, that this is your community?
I think it's a couple of things. So one thing is just on the micro level of being in the yoga class and going around in the beginning of class and having everyone introduce themselves, tell us when they're due, tell us about their kids, and then answer a question. So we have a community developing question of some sort. So we always have an affirmation, and then on that affirmation, we have a question. So it might be something simple like, what's your favorite guilty pleasure? If your baby was named after your food cravings, what would it be named? And then all the way to, how is your mood? How was your birth?
I want you to just tell us a little bit about, so the affirmation is, it doesn't have to be tidy, it's just honest. So tell us a little thing that you want to whine about.
I get shoes thrown at me, I get hit, and then we come here and, oh, she's sweet as pie, right? Sweet as pie here.
Look at her face. You know, I find it really difficult to balance two kids by myself, so that's why she's in daycare, and I feel really guilty because I work.
I just don't like being tired, because then I just feel on edge, and I need more yoga and meditation.
So it can really run the gamut, and so allows the people that participate to really normalize what can happen in parenting, in birth, in pregnancy. So it's not as if anyone's thinking to themselves, well, my position was like this, and that is so weird from what everybody else's was. Or the opposite, what's happening for me is what's happening for everybody else. I find that people really sift themselves into those two categories. And so
well, we have a lot of expectations put on ourselves or
right.
by society of
yep.
what a successful, quote, you know,
absolutely.
Parent is.
Yeah. And if you're not doing that, you figure that you're not doing that and everybody else is doing that. The other piece that's kind of broader than that is that we really want for the space to be a space for conversation. And so that means that it's not only sort of supporting people that are pregnant, birthing, and postpartum, but it's also supporting how, which ways in which we marginalize different people, different conversations. So marginalizing mental health, marginalizing around race. So trying to create space to pull out of the margins ways in which people are not served in birthing and postpartum and pregnancy, but also in other parts of life. Like, how are we supporting families and different families in the way that families can look different? How are we supporting people that don't have access to the services that people that are from a higher socioeconomic bracket have access to? So, like, if you look at the natural birthing world, there is really, and it overlaps with yoga, right? So yoga and the natural birthing world have in common that they are accessible to a certain segment of society. And so from both of those perspectives, looking outside of that segment and going, how can, if we really know that these things work, if we really know that creating community helps to give relief, it should be accessible in a broader way than it has been in the past. Same thing with yoga. If I know that yoga is great for preparing someone for birth, if I know that it's a great tool for pregnancy and postpartum, then I want it to be accessible beyond the boundaries of where it's been accessible. And so starting to think about, like, what are the ways in which it isn't accessible? Is it because we haven't worked hard enough to create a space that seems safe and inclusive? And so how can we be transparent about how we're making that happen?
Well, how do you tackle the challenge of bringing in newcomers? You know, perhaps they haven't even done yoga before, but here's a community and a space that is more than about yoga being a fitness routine, but an inclusive practice.
Yeah, it's so word of mouth. Word of mouth is so important. I think the safety piece, for sure, needs to be communicated from someone that's been in the circle out. Because rarely will I get somebody who is nervous about maybe the mental health piece or nervous about a person of color who doesn't necessarily want to come into a white space. Rarely do you see someone like that just come out of the woodwork. It's somehow it's been communicated that this space is a place for conversation. This is not a place where we're taking anything for granted. And it's built, at least the yoga piece, built some on the foundation of me already having been a teacher for a long time. So there was that piece too. Then there are so many birth workers that work in the space too. And so they, I think, just the inclusion of birth workers creates a level of safety.
Well, and keeping those things in mind, how did you find yourself changing your instructional practice from going from a traditional yoga setting, but then incorporating it into this new setting and also incorporating, you know, your experience as a mother yourself, your educational background in psychology? What kind of things, because you truly had the freedom to form your new practice in your new space. You weren't at the dictation of, say, a gym's guidelines or things. So what were you mindful of and what did you want to accomplish in your own teaching?
I think it's always been really important to me to have a trauma-sensitive perspective. Being a birth doula and experiencing what birth can look like and making sure to include that interoception, so the cueing that this teaching, this work is happening from your body out, not from my instruction on to your body. So I think the mental health piece has always been just right there at the top for me. And also, it's essential also to me that my use of yoga be constantly examined as well, because it's not a tradition that belongs to me as a white person. It's not a tradition that I just can take for granted and say, oh, I want to have this piece and this piece, but I don't want to have this piece. And so that's important to me too. I guess the big piece with the psychology is just the understanding that the body is the doorway in a lot of times to mental health issues, to the healing of trauma. And so what better modality than to be including the body and listening to the body and trusting the wisdom of the body at the same time as finding some stability in our minds and in our hearts. In my experience, you can't do it without it.
We're going to finish up our practice by chanting together. Again, it's just the bookends of our practice for us, for our bodies, our breath, our babies, and these little people that we're so blessed to be with today. And all their crazy.
Amy Kranz is a yoga instructor and the founder of the Womb Room in Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski as part of our monthly Fit for You series back in August. You can hear more of those conversations at WUWM.com, as well as hear an extended interview with Kranz. And that wraps up our All Health show today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered. It's 4 o'clock.